Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We certainly have a full house today. That's very nice to see you all here. Let's see. My notes tell me that this morning we have Central Wisconsin Christian High School with us. If they're here, would you please stand with your advisors? Oh, very nice. Very nice. Please be seated. The students are here in a program that we operate in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they've gotten a little bit of information about the case that's going to be argued this morning that they're going to be present for. And students, if you can stay after the second argument this morning over the lunch break, Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who sits on my right, we'll come out and talk with you a little bit about procedures that go on at the Supreme Court. So please do come back if you're able to do that. You'll notice that at the bench, Justice Michael Gableman is not with us today. He is a bit under the weather, but he is watching oral argument on Wisconsin Eye. So luckily, we have Wisconsin Eye helping us out. He will be participating in the case. He did participate in our pre-argument conference this morning. So with those few preliminaries, I'd like to call the first case, State versus Bartelt. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Leon Todd, and I represent the petitioner, Daniel Bartelt. In this case, Mr. Bartelt asserts that the police violated his Fifth Amendment right to counsel by interrogating him for a second time after he had already requested an attorney the previous day. There are two issues presented with respect to this claim. First, was Mr. Bartelt in custody at the time he asked for an attorney? And second, was his request clear and unambiguous? The answer to both questions is yes. At the time Mr. Bartelt asked for an attorney, he had just confessed at a police station to attacking a woman with a knife. No reasonable person would have felt free to terminate the interview and leave the interrogation room under those circumstances.
If we decide this case the way you suggest, does that allow the person confessing to control the issue of custody?
I don't believe so, Justice, because and the state characterized one of their arguments was that, if I'm correct, then the defendant is allowed to place himself into custody. And I don't think that's an accurate characterization. It's not as if the defendant is in control here and somehow outsmarted the police.
What's your best argument as to what indicia were present regarding traditional indicia of custody were present regarding his statement?
Well, many indicia. Under the totality of the circumstances test, we have to ask whether a reasonable person in the suspect's position would have felt free to leave, considering all the circumstances. We look at...
So was he locked in a room?
He was not locked in a room.
That's what I mean. Go walk through. Was he deprived of anything? Was he... Talk to me about the traditional things we would look at regarding a custody situation.
The place of the interview is a police station, and that's that's an important factor. It suggests that he is in custody.
Well, is it only a police station, or is it a number of things?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It's an interrogation room in the secured internal portion of the police department that's not accessible to the general public. And in this
Describe the building to me a little bit about where this might be.
Sure. The Springer Police Department is located in a municipal building that has other city agencies like parks and planning. You enter the main door to the municipal building, and then there's, I presume, a lobby, but then there's another door to the police department itself, and that leads to the lobby of the police department. Past that is a secure door that's not accessible to the general public. It has to be, for purposes of entry, unlocked by a police officer to gain entry. And I believe the interview room where it took place was 20 to 25 feet past that secure door.
Okay. And would that in and of itself, just walking through that door, would someone be in custody?
It's a factor, but
right. So that's why I'm saying walk me through the factors that mean this spells custody.
Sure. Once he's inside this interrogation room, he's in a secured, police-dominated environment that's not accessible to the general public. He's cut off from the outside world and his normal life, including his friends, family, and also an attorney. We have to also look at the purpose of the interview. And here, this isn't a friendly chat. The police treat Mr. Bartelt as the focus of a serious felony investigation. They openly express their belief to him that they believe he's guilty, and as the Court of Appeals acknowledged,
was there some sort of tone of voice that was inappropriate, or threats or coercive measures taken? Was he handcuffed? Was he threatened? Was he lied to?
He's not handcuffed, and he's not threatened, but the police, as the Court of Appeals acknowledged, they do use psychological pressure that ultimately induces his confession.
Do you have any case that says using psychological pressure to induce a confession is in and of itself enough?
No, and I'm not claiming that he was in custody when this interview began. But the place of the interview, the purpose of the interview, and also his freedom to leave are factors that we have to consider. And then once he confesses, at that point he becomes in custody because a reasonable person would not feel free to leave.
See, that's what I keep hearing you say, and that's what I keep reading when I'm listening to your case, that when he confessed, that controlled the custody decision. How do we write a case that doesn't say that if we rule your way?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
That completely allows the tail to wag the dog. That's just not how it's ever worked, where a custody determination is dependent on someone confessing.
Well, there's a number of cases that have from other states that have found that a reasonable person would not feel free to leave
once they confess
to a serious crime in a police station. And I believe those cases are persuasive. Another factor that you have to consider is that Mr. Bartelt's freedom to actually leave the interrogation room is constrained in a very real way.
Did he ask to leave? Did he say, I want to go now? You know, I'm uncomfortable. I want to leave.
Was he told
he couldn't leave?
Well, after his confession and after he had asked for an attorney, one of the officers does confiscate his cell phone, and another officer tells him to stay in the room when they leave.
No, up to the time of the confession, was he told, you are here, you are not leaving? Was he handcuffed?
He's not handcuffed, and at the beginning of the interview, he is told that he's not under arrest and he's free to leave.
And the door is open.
I believe it's cracked open.
Okay. But it's not shut and locked.
That's correct.
So it is open.
The door to the interview room is open, but the door to the internal portion of the department is locked for purposes of entry. Now, it is true it's not locked for purposes of exiting, but there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Bartelt was aware of that fact. And I think a reasonable person in his position who had to, a police officer had to unlock the door for him to gain entry, would believe that he needs a police officer to unlock it.
Just
to exit.
One more thing.
I think that would be a
You're putting a lot on them being at the police department. Just talk to me a little bit about the circumstances surrounding them being at the Slinger Police Department. That doesn't seem like a typical interview place maybe for these officers. Why Slinger?
Well, I think they choose, I don't know why they chose the Slinger Police Department as opposed to a different police department, but they likely would have chosen a police department so they could be on their home turf, control the interview, isolate Mr. Bartelt from his friends, family, and the outside world, and let him know that they are in control and they have the upper hand.
These are Slinger police officers?
These are not Slinger. I think One is a detective with the Hartford Police Department, and another one is a detective with the Washington County Sheriff's Department.
So it wasn't because it was convenient for the defendant to go there?
I believe it was a halfway point is what the record says.
Okay. All right. I'll be quiet now and let my colleagues take over.
I welcome your questions.
Thank you.
But I think the place of the interview, the purpose of the interview, and his freedom to leave, he's consistently in an interrogation room with two armed police officers. One of them, towards the end of the interview, is sitting just 2 feet in front of him and effectively blocking the path that he would leave.
Counsel?
Yes.
Can we focus a little bit more on the confession and the consequences on whether he's in custody?
Sure.
So if I understand your position correctly, it is that with all of these factors in consideration, once he confessed, he was effectively in custody.
That's
because
correct.
No reasonable person would feel free to leave at that point, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, on page 24 of your brief, you say that there may be situations when a confession does not alter a person's custody status because the confession is simply implausible or because police lack sufficient background information to determine if the confession is genuine, credible. So I'm not sure I understand that part. And the reason I'm not sure is because if it is what the reasonable defendant in that position believes, would he have to have knowledge about the kind of information the police have and whether they consider his confession to be plausible?
Well, I think you have to look at it from the standpoint of a reasonable person in the suspect's position. Now,
how does what the police know factor into what the defendant knows?
It would if the police convey that to the suspect or if the suspect has independent knowledge that the police know that. Like in this case, for example, you know, after Mr. Bartels confesses, it's not that he is merely subjectively in custody because he suspects or he assumes that he's not going to leave. He's objectively in custody because no reasonable person under those circumstances would feel free to leave. He knows the police, he knows he confessed, obviously, and he knows the police heard that confession. And you know, that's similar to if the police, you know, tell him, you're not walking out of here at the conclusion of this interview.
Okay, but they didn't say that.
They didn't
right?
say that.
I believe the record indicates that there was no change in the atmosphere whatsoever between before his confession and afterwards.
Well, I disagree with that, but I also disagree with the Court of Appeals' use of this change of atmosphere standard. And I think there's three reasons why that's wrong.
Okay, and then before you get to that, though, I want to know if you've told me your best argument for why it's important to know what the police think about the plausibility of the confession or whether they have sufficient background information to believe the confession. Have you given me your best argument on that?
That's not the facts of this case, though. Mr. Bartels' confession was very plausible. But to answer your question directly, it's not a matter of what solely the police know. That's a factor. You also have to look at how a reasonable person in the suspect's position would have viewed the situation. And so if somebody, if there's a crackpot who, someone who has a mental health disability and they go into a police station and they're ranting and they're screaming and they're saying, you know, I killed JFK, okay, they may believe subjectively that they're going to be arrested and that they actually did that, but a reasonable person in that position would or should know that that's not a genuine confession. That was the point I was trying to make with that statement. And I think there's other types of confessions that wouldn't necessarily alter a person's custody status. For example, a confession to a misdemeanor, I think many reasonable people would assume that the police might exercise their discretion and not charge them and not arrest them, or that if they were going to be charged with something, they could be summoned to court instead of being arrested. But I want to circle back to the Court of Appeals change in atmosphere standard. Again, I think there's really three major concerns with using that test. And the first flaw in that test is that it's totally inconsistent with the traditional totality of the circumstances test. That test requires that courts consider the totality of all the circumstances. They can't just consider the words and actions of the police. They have to also consider the words and actions of the suspect in the interrogation room. Otherwise, it's not a totality of the circumstances test. And recently, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said in United States versus Patterson that although a defendant's subjective understanding is irrelevant in the determination of custody, quote, his words and actions do bear on the overall atmosphere of the entire interaction and how that atmosphere would impact a reasonable person's perception. And that case is not cited in my brief, but the citation is 826 F3D 450.
Now, do you agree with that case?
Well, the facts of that case are different. I agree with that assertion of law.
Okay, because that case is talking about a change in atmosphere. Right? I mean, that's the point of looking at what the defendant says and what effect that has. Right? Isn't it looking at a change in atmosphere?
Well, it's not looking at a change in atmosphere in the sense of after a defendant confesses, do the police do something additional to further change the atmosphere? If that's the standard, then that renders irrelevant the defendant's words and actions and his statements unless the police further augment them with additional actions or conduct. So you're really turning a blind eye to a good portion of the totality of the circumstances. And I think that's a big flaw with the change in atmosphere test. And, you know, the second flaw with the change in atmosphere test is that it is inconsistent with the spirit of the Miranda ruling. The Miranda rule is designed to protect people who are not objectively free to leave and thus in custody from the inherently compelling pressures that stem from custodial interrogation. So if you have a person who has just confessed and would not objectively feel free to leave, they are by definition subject to that inherently coercive environment. And a person in that position should therefore have the protections of the Miranda-Edwards rule, regardless of whether the police do something additional to further change the atmosphere of the interrogation.
But, counsel, if we go that direction, wouldn't we be overlooking the teaching of State versus Claps, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, that discusses who it is that creates the conditions of custody. Right? In what it says, the court held, to summarize, we hold that when an individual is taken into custody or otherwise deprived of his freedom by the authorities, isn't the significance of looking at the change of atmosphere as the Court of Appeals did, because we're focusing on what the authorities do, not what's going on inside the defendant's head, but what the authorities do to put that defendant in a custodial position.
I think Claps is distinguishable for, again, three main reasons. First, the defendant in Claps, the reason he couldn't leave had nothing to do with the police. It was because he was in a hospital emergency room and presumably injured and then therefore unable to leave. So, you know, in that situation, although he wasn't free to leave the hospital, he was still free to terminate the interview and ask the police to leave his hospital room. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because if you're in your own home and the police are questioning you, the test wouldn't be, are you free to leave your own home? The test should be, are you free to terminate the interview and ask the police to leave? The defendant in Claps could have done that. Mr. Bartel couldn't do that because he was on their turf in the interrogation room in the police department. So they were in control of that room and the atmosphere. Mr. Bartel couldn't ask them to leave.
Well, hang on a second now. Aren't you assuming your conclusion? Because from all objective points, he could have asked them to stop the questioning, and they had told them he was free to leave. So it appears that he is on par with Claps in the sense of nothing had happened that occurred that where the authorities said you can't leave, or you got to answer our questions, or you're under arrest, or any of that. So aren't you assuming your conclusions when you say this is different from Claps?
I don't think I'm assuming that conclusion. I think I'm analyzing the circumstances that existed after his confession based on what a reasonable person would have felt in those circumstances. I don't think any reasonable person would have felt free to terminate the interview and leave the room. I think a reasonable person would have assumed, if I try to walk out of here, the police are going to physically stop me.
Okay. And just so I make, so I'm clear on what your position is, it's not based on anything the authorities did any differently after the confession. It's just what he was thinking.
That's not what I'm saying. I do think that the authorities and Mr. Bartel both did things after the confession
that changed
the atmosphere.
Okay, good. So tell me what the authorities did after the confession that changed the atmosphere.
After the confession, well, let me back up. Before that, they had focused on trying to get a general confession from Mr. Bartel, and they applied that psychological pressure that the Court of Appeals was talking about, that they expressed confidence in his guilt. They tried to minimize the seriousness of the actions and look for an explanation as to why he did that. After his confession, they switch gears and start asking him detailed questions about the attack itself. And I think those detailed questions are indicative of an interrogation that has become custodial in nature. Mr. Bartel also becomes more emotional after that confession. He says that he has that monologue about how he's scared and life scares him and he's not confident. And one of the detectives tells him, you should be scared. Also, in the cases where courts have found no change in atmosphere, or at least some of them, the suspects were reassured after the confession that they were still free to leave. They were allowed unaccompanied and unrestrained movement throughout the police station. That didn't happen in this case. After his confession, Bartelt isn't Mirandized. He isn't told he's still free to leave. He isn't allowed to walk around the police station. They zero in and they ask him specific questions about the offense, and after he asks for an attorney, they tell him to stay in the room and they confiscate his cell phone, and he is ultimately arrested as a result of that.
Counsel,
yes.
The test for years under U.S. Supreme Court precedent and Wisconsin precedent has been under the totality of the circumstances. Whether, I'm paraphrasing, a reasonable person would feel free to leave. That's been the test for custody. Did I accurately state that test, or do you want to nuance that?
I believe that's the test.
Okay. Now, is the atmosphere or any sphere, that is part of the totality of the circumstances? Or is this something else that's independent of the totality of the circumstances?
Yeah, I don't know. And part of the issue here is that the atmosphere of the interrogation, that's a very vague term. And what does that mean? I think we need to not use amorphous terms like that, but look at the objective circumstances of what happened.
Apply the test. What was the confession?
The confession is one to attacking a woman with a knife. It's a confession to a serious, violent crime. It takes place at a police station. The detectives have already expressed confidence in Mr. Bartelt's guilt. He also knows they have a composite sketch that closely resembles him. There's a locked door to this.
So as I understand it, his confession then, from what you're telling me, although he started in saying he wasn't at the park and explaining his injury on his hand, he confessed after interrogation. I was at the park, and yes, I did attack her. Is that his confession?
Well,
or is it not? I mean, this is not difficult. Did he confess to being at the park after having previously denied being at the park?
Yes, he confessed.
Did he confess to attacking her?
Yes.
Okay. Now, after initially denying all this stuff and then confessing that he was at the park and confessing that he attacked her, if he had said, okay, see you later, and got up to leave, What would that have been a reasonable expectation?
No.
And why not?
I don't think it's reasonable to believe that the police would let a suspect go after they'd been specifically questioning him about a violent crime. He confesses to that violent crime at a police station. I think any reasonable person under those circumstances would feel that they are effectively under arrest, and they would expect the police to stop any attempt they might make to leave the room.
Counsel, even accepting that, and the issue we've been talking about is, was he in custody or wasn't he, right?
That's correct.
All right. Let's assume for the moment that he was in custody. But then the question is, in this case, whether he asked for a lawyer. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Unambiguously. And so what he said is, should I or can I speak to a lawyer or anything? And the officer answered, sure, yes, that is your option. And then the defendant, according to the testimony, answered he would prefer having one present. Now, even if you accept him under custody, where is an unambiguous, unequivocal request for counsel?
I think the context of that exchange shows that the request is clear and unambiguous. This isn't a situation where Mr. Bartel made a request for an attorney out of the blue and said something like, I think I need a lawyer, I think I might want an attorney. And a statement like that could be interpreted to be ambiguous. It could suggest that the defendant is still just contemplating the possibility of requesting a lawyer. But that's not what happened in this case. Mr. Bartel, like you said, had already asked the detective if he could speak to a lawyer. The detective told him that he could. And that prior exchange sets up an election for Mr.
What
Bartel.
What did the detective say? That's your option?
He says, Mr. Bartel says, should I or can I speak to a lawyer or anything? And the detective says, sure, yes, that is your option.
Okay.
And that, a prior exchange, sets up an election between binary choices, either having an attorney or not having an attorney. There really wasn't anything else for Mr. Bartel to do at that point except choose an attorney, and he did that by saying, I think I prefer that, meaning I think I prefer to have a lawyer. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Assistant Solicitor General Amy Miller, on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. Bartel does ask this Court to hold that a suspect can place himself in police custody. This cannot be the rule. Not only is it inconsistent with established principles of Miranda, but it would add confusion in an area of law that is already less than clear. Only the police can place people in police custody. Miranda itself held that it applies when a person is taken into custody or otherwise deprived of his freedom by the authorities. This court in State v. Claps explained that the conditions of custody are those caused or created by the authorities. The state bears the burden of proof as to custody because it is the state that is responsible for creating the conditions of custody.
Counsel, you framed the question as, can a suspect place himself in custody? I think the answer might be no. So what is the question that we have to focus on in deciding whether someone is in custody?
The question is whether law enforcement has taken some action to place the suspect in custody.
Why isn't the question, under the totality of the circumstances, would a reasonable person feel that they are free to leave? Why isn't that the question? I mean, I've written cases in both majority and dissent for years that have said that's the question. So why is it now, can a suspect place himself in custody? Why is that now the question we're focusing on?
Well, whether a reasonable person will feel free to leave is an overbroad formulation of the custody analysis. It sweeps in situations that are not custodial.
So that no longer is the test, should no longer be the test in Wisconsin. Is
that
correct?
Well, that is the point that the Supreme Court made in House v. Fields, that there is something more to custody than simply whether a person would feel free to leave. And in State v. Claps, this court made a similar point that even though the defendant there would not have felt free to leave, he was nevertheless not in custody because it was not an action of law enforcement that caused him to feel that he could not leave.
Let me posit, if I may, the same question that I asked of your opposing counsel, and that is, after being brought into the station, and the defendant denying he was at the park, of course denying that he had anything to do with this, trying to explain away the cut or injury that he had on his arm or hand. And then the interrogation ensued, saying several times, officers saying, "You're lying, say the truth, you're going to be better off," that kind of approach that we see oftentimes in transcripts. So then he, and I'm skipping over a lot of detail that might be important to you, so I don't mean to skip over it in terms of the bigger picture, but I don't need it for my question. So then he gets to the point of saying, okay, I was at the park, and okay, I did attack her, and okay, see it, I'm leaving. Would a reasonable person under those circumstances, given the nature of the offense, have felt free to leave?
Well, a person might expect that law enforcement will arrest them or will prevent them from leaving.
Could you, my question is whether a reasonable person, I don't care about any old person, I don't care about subjective belief, I care about objectively, would the reasonable person have felt free to leave?
Well, a reasonable person might not feel comfortable simply walking away because they would expect that the police will try to stop them. But an expectation of action is not the same as action. This is one of the flaws in Bartelt's test, is that he equates the expectation of police action with actual police action.
So I know that, for instance, Detective Clausing later testified to the detective's subjective belief that the defendant would not have felt free to leave. I know that, but that's what Detective Clausing testified later to, and that was his subjective belief. I want to try to get an answer to the question of whether a reasonable person would have felt free to leave, given my scenario of confessing to this crime and then saying, okay, see you later, and getting up and leaving.
Well, a person might not have felt comfortable leaving. A reasonable person, yes, but it would not have been based on anything the police have done. It would have been based on their assumptions about what the police might do in the future. And again, custody is not based on what we assume the police might do in the future. It is based on what the police have actually done. Have the police restrained the suspect? Have the police curtailed his freedom of movement to the extent associated with formal arrest? And so this is one of the flaws in Bartelt's test, is to equate the expectation of action with action. But until the police take some action consistent with that expectation, they have not placed the suspect in custody. If, contrary to expectations, they simply maintain the non-custodial status quo, then the suspect remains not in custody. Now, once police do take an action to objectively indicate that indeed they are arresting the suspect, they are preventing him from leaving, it is at that point that the suspect is placed in custody. Here, that did not occur until after Bartelt had made comments about an attorney. At that point, Detective Clausing took Bartelt's cell phone from him and did not allow him to use it. That was an objective indication from law enforcement that indeed Bartelt was not free to leave, that they were controlling his actions, controlling his ability to communicate with the outside world, and that he was not free to leave. It is at this point that Bartelt can be considered to have been in custody. Another problem.
Counsel, are you proposing a bright line rule that, or perhaps reiterating a bright line rule, that it is the actions of the authorities and only the actions of the authority that are capable of putting a suspect in custody?
Those are the only actions that can place a suspect in custody, although they are not the only actions that are relevant to the totality of the circumstances. There are surrounding circumstances that would color or affect how we would view police actions.
And wouldn't a confession to a violent crime be one of those?
Yes, absolutely. It could color how we would view subsequent police conduct. So conduct, if undertaken in response to a confession, could weigh more heavily towards custody than that same conduct had it been undertaken prior to the confession.
Okay. So if the confession does not engender some action or change in atmosphere by the authorities, then we don't consider the confession as a part of the custody equation.
Right. The confession would just affect how you would view the subsequent actions of the authorities, but it cannot itself create custody. Custody must be created by the authorities. A second problem with Bartelt's test is that it views the entire test for custody as simply whether a person would feel free to leave. But there is more to custody than simply whether a person would feel free to leave. For instance, in class, as this court explained, that feeling must be caused by an action of law enforcement. Law enforcement must do something to make the person feel that they are not free to leave and that they are in custody. By using this overbroad and incomplete definition of custody, Bartelt's test sweeps in situations that are not custodial. Finally, another problem, aside from the legal problems with Bartelt's test, is that it would generate confusion in an already confusing area of law and make it more difficult for law enforcement, who must make in-the-moment judgments as to whether a suspect is in custody. It would force law enforcement to make guesses as to the seriousness of the offense at issue, as to how incriminating a suspect's question is, as to whether or not the suspect should be believed, all with the threat of suppression if they guess wrong. This is an unreasonable burden to place on law enforcement. Indeed, the Supreme Court in Berthamer rejected the government's similar argument that misdemeanors should not apply to Miranda should not apply to misdemeanors because it would be unreasonable to ask the law enforcement to guess as to the level of crime at issue before deciding how they could interview a suspect. The same is true here. Aside from the legal problems with Bartelt's test, these practical problems are just one more reason for this court to reject it. Instead, this court should apply established principles of Miranda custody.
Counsel, what's the confusing area of the law to which you made reference?
Well, the precise moment of custody.
Well, but we know the law is clear in stating what custody is. It's that applying it to particular facts can be difficult. It's not confusing.
Precisely. As this court explained in State v. Griffin, it was already difficult for law enforcement to determine the precise moment of custody, even when that moment is within their control.
Because the test set out is, would a reasonable person feel free to terminate the interview and leave here at the interrogation room, right? That's quite a simple stated test, not too easy to apply.
That is part of the test, but it is not the entire test for custody.
Okay, what's the entire test?
The entire test for custody is whether law enforcement has restrained the suspect in such a way as to create an inherently coercive environment. There are plenty of situations in which people might not feel free to leave that are not custodial. And again, this is one of the flaws in Bartelt's test. He sweeps in situations.
Give me an example where I'm not free to leave, but it's not custodial. They stop me on the highway?
Correct. That is not a situation that is custodial, even if a reasonable person would not feel free to leave the scene of a traffic stop.
They keep me too long. It does become custodial.
Exactly. If law enforcement does something more than just making you not feel free to leave, then the situation becomes custodial. Because, again, it's more to custody than simply whether someone feels free to leave. So if this court applies established principles of Miranda custody to the facts of this case, Bartelt was not in custody until after he made comments about an attorney. Bartelt came voluntarily to the Slinger Police Department. He was not frisked. He was not restrained. The door was left ajar. He was told that he was not under arrest and that he was free to leave at any time. The officers were not in uniform, and although they did have their weapons were holstered, and they never so much as alluded to their weapons during the interview. They spoke to Bartelt in a calm, conversational tone. They were very respectful, and the interview lasted only 30 minutes. As the Court of Appeals found, nearly all of these factors weigh against a finding of custody. After Bartelt confessed, the officers changed nothing about the circumstances of this interview. They continued to speak to Bartelt in a calm, conversational tone. They asked the same kinds of questions they had been asking the entire time. They never moved to restrain Bartelt or indicated to him in any way that he was no longer free to leave. It was not until after Bartelt made comments about an attorney that Detective Quazing took Bartelt's cell phone. At this point, law enforcement indicated to Bartelt objectively that he was not free to leave, that indeed they were arresting him, and that they would not allow him to leave. They were controlling his actions. At this point, Bartelt was in custody. Prior to this, Bartelt remained not in custody, and so when he made comments about an attorney, he could not invoke Edwards. Edwards can only be invoked when a suspect is in custody, and it cannot be invoked anticipatorily. Since Bartelt was not in custody when he made comments about an attorney, he could not invoke Edwards regardless of what he said.
Isn't it easier to say he did not make an unambiguous invocation of his right to counsel than to fuss with custody? I mean, you have to be both in custody and two, unambiguously, unequivocally ask for a lawyer. Custody might be a little hard to figure out, right? Because although the test can be stated simply, application to the facts might not be. But why, where did he unambiguously ask for counsel?
Well, the state believes that the court does not need to address that issue because Bartelt was not in custody. Even if Bartelt was in custody, his statements were not clear and unequivocal enough to invoke.
That's right.
Edwards.
That's part two in your brief, starting at page 39. And anything that might have a question mark in it or any statement that says, I prefer, I think I should, this court and other courts have said that's ambiguous and equivocal, and we're not going to recognize it. You know, the more I read those cases, the more I think about them, even though some of them I join, I think that's silly. I think it's just silly to say that when the defendant says, oh, I better have a lawyer, or I think I should have a lawyer, or I think we ought to get a lawyer for me. I mean, a person is entitled, constitutional right to have a lawyer, right?
Not necessarily.
In custody.
When they are in custody, they have a right under Miranda to an attorney.
Right. And so if they look like they're thinking about having a lawyer and they're expressing themselves in the vernacular rather than in technical terms that this court or other courts have said, which seemed to me to be, I want a lawyer now. They said that would be, I think, clear enough. Anything less than that raises questions. So if you leave out now, then it's ambiguous as to whether you want it now, or you want it whenever you get to court, et cetera. So, I mean, why are we fussing with that? A person has a constitutional right to a lawyer if they want a lawyer, right?
Well, the Supreme Court in Davis held that a request for counsel must be clear and unambiguous. To allow ambiguous statements to invoke the right to counsel would require departing from Supreme Court case law.
I think that's a good idea because I think that is not a very sound case. People do not always speak in precise, declarative sentences. They say things that's confrontational. They prefer not to be confrontational. They prefer to soften it. And why are we, and then we come up, get to trial court, you get to the Court of Appeals, you get to the State Supreme Court, you might even get to the United States Supreme Court. And that's such a waste of energy, a waste of judicial time, a waste of counsel time. The guy says something that indicates, that's pretty broad, that he wants a lawyer. Why not give it to him?
In fact, if
the studies show that if you have a lawyer, that the defendant has a lawyer, it's easier for the system to deal with it. Because the lawyer can tell the client, you don't have a fighting chance, buddy. Let's just go with the best deal you can get. Whereas if he doesn't have a lawyer, he has visions of great success that are totally wrong.
Counsel, I have a question for you.
I thought
that was a statement. Is that a question?
Yes.
Okay.
Why not give him a lawyer? If he asks for a lawyer, give him a lawyer.
I think she responded.
Faster.
The U.S. Supreme Court
said unless
he's in custody when he asks for a lawyer, it isn't a valid request.
Do you want us to overturn the law, as Justice Abramson suggests?
Why can't we go on the Wisconsin law?
Under the Wisconsin Constitution, this court could create a different standard, could create a higher standard for law enforcement, but that must be justified.
Let's assume we're not going to do that today. Let's talk about what the law is and what we require of our officers. You have a person that comes in, and you set a time and a place to meet, and you say, gosh, you know, it's in between where you are and where I am, so why don't we just meet at the Slinger Police Department? Person says, okay, my friends will take me there, and his friends drop him off. He then spends some time talking to law enforcement in a room where their guns are in their holsters. I think they may have even been in plain clothes. The door is open to the room. They have a discussion. He's starting to get caught up in some inconsistencies, pretty smart person, and might realize, uh-oh, I could be in trouble here. Exactly when did the officers give this particular suspect Miranda warnings? And I want to make sure counsel that's arguing the case for the defense and I are on the same page, because he referenced two officers, one from Hartford and one from the Sheriff's Department. That was the second day interview. So I want to make sure we have our facts correct as to there were two interviews. First day, 24-hour break. Second day starts with Miranda, as I understand it, right?
Right.
First day, discussion is going on. There's an argument that he really wasn't free to leave. He was in custody, so some issues come up in that regard. They almost look like voluntariness issues, but it's kind of a custody argument counsel's making. Exactly when did he make the statements that were inculpatory on the first interview, and exactly when was he Mirandized, if at all, and when did he invoke his right to counsel, and did he talk at all after the right to counsel on the first interview?
During the first interview, Bartelt began to make inculpatory statements in about 20 minutes into the interview when he first admitted to having been at the park. Then the rest of his confession kind of came out piecemeal for the next several minutes. He made comments about counsel, but at that point he did not invoke the right
throughout,
to counsel.
He wove comments about counsel throughout?
Oh, no, after his confession was complete.
Okay, so if we were going to pull this DVD and look at it, where would that be? About 20 minutes in?
At the point he made comments about counsel, I think it was about 25 minutes in or so, he had made his confession. The officers then asked him to make a written statement. He asked him questions about what a written statement is. The officers explained it to him. And then he asked about a lawyer. And then after he asked about a lawyer, the officers asked a few more questions of him.
Was it just right away? He asked for a lawyer and the officers just continued on without any stops at all?
The officer responded, okay, that is your option. He said, I think I'd prefer that. The officer said, all right. The other officer then asked some questions about where Bartelt's van was located. And then a detective pausing took Bartelt's cell phone, and the officers left the room. And when they returned, they told Bartelt that he was under arrest. They placed him in handcuffs and placed him under arrest. Now, they did not read Bartelt the Miranda warnings at this time. The record shows the first time Bartelt was read Miranda warnings was at the second interview. And then he waived his rights during the second interview and spoke to police for about 90 minutes. And at the end of that interview, he said, if we're going to talk more, I would like a lawyer here. And at that point, the interview ended because he had invoked his right to counsel. He was in custody and unequivocally invoked his right to counsel.
Okay, thank you for that more complete picture.
But this court need not reach the issue of whether Bartelt's request for counsel was unequivocal. Bartelt was not in custody at the time he made these comments, and so regardless of what the standard is, regardless of what he said, he could not invoke his right to counsel. The right to counsel attaches only when suspects are in custody.
And what law do you rely on to support that position?
That Edwards only applies when the suspect is in custody?
Right.
The U.S. Supreme Court most recently reiterated that in Montejo v. Louisiana, that Miranda Edwards applies only when suspects are in custody, although they have iterated that statement many times in the past. And then this court in State v. Lankowski also explained that Miranda only applies when a suspect is in custody and that a suspect cannot anticipatorily invoke his rights under Miranda. He must first be placed in custody.
That's why the argument here is whether he was in custody, because if he was in custody, he wasn't properly Mirandized. If he wasn't in custody, then they had no requirement to give him Miranda.
Precisely, precisely. And Bartelt does not argue that he was improperly denied the Miranda warnings, but if he was placed in custody, those would be required. And any statement he made without having been given those warnings would be admissible.
But he doesn't argue Miranda.
Correct, correct.
They argue whether or not he was in custody, and they argue whether there was an unambiguous indication of his right.
Correct.
So if we were going to go further than that, we should get new briefs.
Exactly, exactly. That issue was not raised here. Edwards was raised here.
That's right. And that's what we've been talking about, these two issues.
Correct.
If he's in custody, he has the right to have his Miranda warnings.
Correct.
If they're going to keep talking to him in custody.
Correct.
That's why the second day, law enforcement, right at the beginning, gave Miranda warnings, right?
Correct, correct.
When he mentioned the lawyer, these people left the room on the previous day, right?
Correct.
He was not given Miranda warnings before that because he was free to leave and told that at least, I think, once or twice, right?
Correct. He was told he was free to leave once. He was told he was not under arrest twice.
So what we're really focusing on, I think, are these words, and correct me if I'm wrong, vis-a-vis the invocation of a right to an attorney at the first day, okay? And they appear several places, but I'm reading Mr. Bartelt, should I or can I speak to a lawyer or anything? Detective Clousing, sure, yes, that is your option. Mr. Bartelt, I'd prefer that. Detective Clousing, all right. Those are the words we're focusing on as to whether Mr. Bartelt was requesting an attorney and whether Detective Clousing a reasonable detective would have understood that to be a request for an attorney. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what do you take of Detective Clousing saying, all right, after the defendant said, okay, I think I'd prefer that? How are we to interpret that, all right?
Well, I don't think that indicates that that Detective Clousing understood that Bartelt was unambiguously requesting counsel or that he was indicating that he desired to deal with them only through counsel. He just acknowledge that Bartelt has said he thinks he'd prefer a lawyer. But that doesn't mean that he needs a lawyer there now, that he is requesting counsel. It just means that he might be requesting counsel.
And then what happened, what was said or done immediately after Detective Pausing said, all right?
And Detective Walsh then asked Bartelt some questions about his van, where it was located. He showed Bartelt a drawing, and Bartelt drew on the drawing where his van was located.
Okay, those would be incriminating questions if he were... Those would be incriminating questions regardless if he's in custody or not.
It's possible that they might be incriminating. The lower courts made no determination as to whether...
Well, I mean, didn't the eyewitness here, that is, the victim, the only... identification she had was that it was a blue van. That's how they brought him in for questioning, because he had a blue van.
That's correct.
So the questions right after, all right, going to his blue van would seem to me, the blue van at the scene of the crime, would seem to me at least to be potentially incriminating. Would you grant me that?
Yes, it's possible.
Okay. Then after the questions about his blue van, then what happened? I really am interested in the sequence. So then Detective Walsh asked about his blue van. Then what? What's the next thing?
At that point, Detective Clausing then asked Bartelt if he could see his cell phone. Bartelt took out his cell phone.
And give me the details. I mean, didn't he ask because he saw something coming on the screen of the cell phone?
No, that was prior. When Bartelt's phone had rang, Bartelt asked if he could answer it, and the police said sure. He looked at his phone, chose not to answer it, and put it back in his pocket. Then after the confession, after the comments about the attorney, and after Walsh's questions about the van, Detective Clausing asked again, can I see your cell phone? I'm going to take it, and took it out of Bartelt's hand. Bartelt asked if he could look at the call, and Detective Clausing said, no, I need that call. And then Detective Clausing said, I can show you who called if you'd like. Do I have your permission to view that call? He asked Bartelt exactly how he would view the call, and then told Bartelt that his mom had called. Explained to Bartelt that he had been at his parents' house prior to coming to the interrogation room into the Slinger Police Department, and that's probably why his mom was wondering where he was. At that point,
good mother. Always worried, I guess. So when Detective Walsh was asking the potentially incriminating questions about his blue van that had been observed at the scene, at that time, it's the position of the state that the defendant was free to leave. Is that correct?
That he had not been placed in custody.
My question is that the defendant was free to leave. Is that correct?
Well, there's no indication from law enforcement that he was not free to leave.
So the answer to my question is, it's the state's position that when he was being asked about those potentially incriminating questions vis-a-vis the blue van, that he could have said, see you later.
Yes, based on the objective circumstances of the interview, yes, he could have left.
Okay.
If there are no more questions.
Counsel, just one final question.
Okay.
You stated that custody consists of two elements. One, whether the authorities have done anything that would create an atmosphere that would lead a reasonable person to believe that they're not free to leave, and two, whether there was a coercive atmosphere within the meaning of Miranda.
Correct.
Which one of those elements was not met in this case?
I don't think either element was met in this case.
Is the bulk of your argument focused on the not free to leave portion of that test?
I see my red light.
Yes, your red light is on. You can answer this question. Thank you.
I think the argument applies to both, almost equally to both elements of the test, because there was no action of law enforcement. So if there's no action of law enforcement, the suspect cannot be restrained, and law enforcement cannot create a coercive atmosphere without taking some action.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, this is the sort of case where I sit up here and I feel as if the court is being asked to kind of Monday morning quarterback the game. I think we're being asked, after we have the luxury of spending hours reviewing transcripts and the law, we're being asked to sit back and say, well, detective, well, officer, next time you're faced with these myriad facts and circumstances, let me tell you how to do your job better next time. And that's the problem, I think, with totality of the circumstances tests. They're not conducive to producing a rule of law that says, officer, in these circumstances, here's what you're supposed to do. So my question for you is, how are the police supposed to know when an atmosphere in these types of circumstances changes to the extent that an interview is transformed into a custodial interrogation requiring the interviewee to be Mirandized? In other words, what rule are you asking this court to write so the police know what they're supposed to do, exactly when during the course of an interview they are supposed to Mirandize a suspect?
I'm not asking for any new rule. I'm just asking this court to apply the traditional totality of the circumstances test, which is, would a reasonable person have felt free to leave under the circumstances? And I think when a suspect confesses to a serious violent crime at a police station in the presence of police who are interrogating him or her about that very crime, as the court in People v. Rippick said, it is utter sophistry to pretend that a reasonable person in those circumstances would feel free to get up and leave a police station.
That sounds like a bright-line rule to me. Are you asking us to depart from the totality of the circumstances test and say, okay, officers, okay, law enforcement, whenever somebody confesses to a certain level of a felony or any felony, you got to administer Miranda warnings because they are now in custody, even though you haven't told them you aren't free to leave, you haven't handcuffed them, you haven't told them you're under arrest. Is that the rule you're asking us to write?
Again, I'm not asking for a rule. I'm asking the court to apply the totality of the circumstances test. And if this court finds that...
But how is law enforcement supposed to know when somebody, the reasonable person, this proverbial reasonable person, now feels like they're not able to leave? How is law enforcement supposed to know when somebody feels something?
Well, they need to consider not what a specific person feels, but what a reasonable person would feel objectively. And I think if this court rules in Mr. Bartelt's favor, as I'm requesting, and holds that he wasn't objectively free to leave under the circumstances of this case, I think that's going to provide pretty clear guidance to law enforcement. They're going to be able to take that decision and say, hey, when a person is in similar circumstances, when they confess to a serious violent crime at a police station.
It has to be a violent crime. Is that part of the rule? Because I'm interested in rules. Again, the totality of the circumstances test really results in judges just sitting there saying, you know, whatever the majority says, yeah, that's reasonable. That's going to be the rule today. I need a rule.
Well, I think police are going to be able to use that decision, again, if this court rules in Bartelt's favor, to say, if a defendant confesses to a serious violent crime at a police station, we should Mirandize him before we proceed with further questioning.
Okay. So then let's talk about this case just a little bit. When should they have administered the Miranda warnings?
If they were going to continue to interrogate him, they should have administered those warnings after he confessed. And I want to...
Okay, so not when he walked in, not when the door locked behind him, not when he went into the interrogation room, not when law enforcement was sitting across the table, not when any of those things happened. It should have been as soon as he began to confess to a crime, they should say, stop, you've begun to confess to a crime, I need to administer Miranda warnings.
They're not required to cut him off once he starts making a voluntary statement, but after the confession is complete, before they proceed with further interrogation, they should Mirandize him. And I want to make one point.
Well, but that would be before he's in custody, because he wasn't in custody then. And Miranda applies when you are in custody. So that's the glitch. You're asking us to follow some other rule that has not been established. You have to Mirandize, or before you question someone who's in custody, they need their Miranda warnings. So what statements were made post-custody here?
Well, my argument is that after the confession, that's when he's in custody. And the state...
What statements were made post-custody?
There was reference to statements made about his van. I think there's an important point that needs to be made about that. Detective Walsh wasn't in the room when Mr. Bartelt requested an attorney. He didn't hear that, and then he came back in and asked him about the van. I think if you look at Detective I'm sorry, I see my light is
on. You can finish your answer.
I think if we look at Detective Clossing's response to that request, the one that heard it, his response to that request shows that he understood it as a request for counsel. In fact, he testified to that multiple times at the suppression hearing that Mr. Bartelt had requested a lawyer.
So okay. You're asking for that car statement to be eliminated? Only.
No, I'm asking that this court suppress Mr. Bartelt's statements to police during the second interview that occurred the next day and all physical derivative evidence that police obtained as a result of those statements, and remand the case to the trial court to make the determination of which specific items of derivative evidence should be suppressed.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for very, very interesting arguments. Your briefs were well done and the arguments most enjoyable, so thank you very much. You did a great job for us. We're going to take a brief recess now so the students here can leave and go on about their Capitol tour, and other attorneys can take your places at council table. We are adjourned.